It's the 21st of September, 1949, Liverpool, England. The new independent Republic of Ireland team are facing the might of English football at Goodison Park. England are heavy favourites. They've never lost a game on home soil to any so-called foreign team. That is to say, a team that does not reside inside the UK or the Commonwealth. Over 50,000 people have packed their way in to watch. In the early parts of the game, Ireland goalkeeper Tommy Godwin is earning his place. England pepper his goal with shots, but Godwin stands firm. He's having the game of his life. And at 33 minutes, Peter Desmond is tripped in the penalty area as he tries to collect a pass from Tommy O'Connor on the left-hand side of the box. Penalty. Con Martin tries to go down the middle with his penalty, but Bert Williams gets a big hand to it, but it just manages to creep over the line. 1-0 to Ireland. Captain Johnny Carey would win man of the match. With shades of Paul McGrath and Roberto Baggio 45 years later, Carey keeps the great Tom Finney firmly in his pocket. The match rolls on, and so too the minutes. England become increasingly desperate. The Irish defending is helter-skelter at times. Balls bouncing around the box only to be hoofed clear. England forward Jesse Pye hits the crossbar. But it's Everton's own Peter Farrell who would seal the game. Once again, a pass from Tommy O'Connor sets Ireland up. Across from the wing comes in. Williams leaves his line to collect, but Farrell gets there first and nods it over him. It's 2-0, and with that, the match. It's arguably one of the Republic of Ireland's finest ever wins. Away from home and against a team much slated as the best in the world, they win. England had lost their first ever game on home soil to a foreign team, and so entered the heroes of Goodison into football history forever. Goalkeeper, Tommy Godwin. Captain, Johnny Carey, Tom O'Hearn, Billy Walsh, Con Martin, Tommy Maroney, Peter Corr, Peter Farrell, Davy Walsh, Peter Desmond, and Tommy O'Connor.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, along with Gary Spain. Don't forget you can support us on Patreon for just €5 a month, where we put that money back into the podcast to get more ears listening to us. Just go to patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. And please share the podcast on your socials and WhatsApp and spread the word about Green Shoots. So let's get down to this week's show.
We'll start off this week's podcast by talking about a little bit of recent history that just happened. It's not usual that we start off the show like that, but it has to be talked about, I think, in the context of how historical it was, Gary. The league match at the weekend at the Aviva Stadium, 33,208 fans turn up to watch Bowes against Shamrock Rovers. An extraordinary crowd, first of all, but I suppose give us the historical context of how amazing it was to see that kind of size of a crowd at a league game.
Yeah, no, it was phenomenal. And I'm proud to say I was one of the 33,208 that was there. And as a neutral, I really enjoyed the occasion, the game, etc. And it is great to see, because as someone who's been, I'm going to the League of Ireland since the early 70s, and you're not really used to that crowds. In fact, if anything, I would talk about the crowds in the early 70s, you would have seen in places like Cork and Waterford. There was a famous game in 1972 when Hibs played Waterford, which was effectively a league decider in Floor Lodge, and they reckon the crowd was between 22 and 25,000. It had thought that the previous record was the year before, actually, because Hibs played Rovers. They both finished level, and there was a playoff for the title in 1971 at Dalymount, and there was 28,000 at that. But a bit of research by Jerry Farrer, the Bohemians historian, And he has come up with what he believes to be the record crowd prior to Sunday. And I don't think anyone's going to be able to disprove him. It's a very, very, very difficult thing to pin down, because if you go back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, they might publish the gate receipts, but they wouldn't typically publish the attendance. But there was a crucial game in 1946. We talked about Cork United in the last podcast, and a team that didn't exist at the turn of the decade in the 1940s and didn't exist either at the end of the decade. But incredibly, they won five league titles. The last of those league titles was in 1946, when it was their fifth title in six seasons. They played Drumcondra in a crucial league game. Drumcondra actually finished runners-up, 2 points behind Cork United. And mainly one of the key results near the end of the season was a crucial draw for Cork United in Dublin. So Drums, I was actually reading some Drums programmes from that season, and they were averaging a crowd of around 14,000 people in Talca Park at the time.
What?
But Talca Park was... they were a huge team in the north side of Dublin. They were the team of Bertie Ahern. Maybe we shouldn't be talking about Bertie Ahern, but I know he was a big, big Drumcondra fan as a boy. But anyway, I digress. In 1946, Drumcondra were pushing hard for a first league title. They were getting phenomenal crowds in Talca Park. But Cork United, the glamour team at the time, were coming to town, and they had to move it a mile or two up the road to Dalymount Park. And the newspaper reports at the time gave a record gate cash-wise, but the estimated attendance was 30,000 people. So that, I suppose, as far as we knew, was the and thanks to Gerry Farrell for this research, was the record crowd for a League of Ireland game at the time and up until last Sunday. So game finished in a one-all draw, a crucial point for Cork United. They pipped Drums to the title. Drumcondra did have some consolation in that they beat their big Dublin rival Shamrock Rovers in the FAI Cup final in another epic and a hugely attended 1946 FAI Cup final. Drums won that 2-1, so they did have the consolation of winning the cup. There were also, we did mention it in a previous podcast, they remain the only non-league side to have won the FAI Cup. In 1927, as a non-league side, they shocked Brideville after a replay. But, so there we go. I mean, the crowds in those days, 14,000 in Talca Park, 30,000, they had to move it to Dalymount. Maybe they lost a little in home advantage, but it was actually quite common in those days. Clubs would cash in if they had a big league game. St. Pat's did it, Shamrock Rovers did it. Obviously, Bows were already there, but all the big clubs would move big games to Dalymount to basically cash in on the bigger capacity.
Now, we mentioned this on the show before, right? So I'm going to put in a caveat here or play devil's advocate with these attendance numbers, right? We've talked before about how on really big games, you know, FAI Cup finals or big playoff games, there is 1,000 or so people who manage to squeeze their way unofficially into the park or something like that, or a couple of thousand people would find ways to get into the park, jump over the wall or squeeze through the gate, or do you know what I mean? Oh, I'm just bringing my kid through, do you know, those kind of things like you used to do in the old days. So I'm not saying it's not true that this is the official thing. I'm just putting a caveat there that I think somewhere along the way, somewhere else has the record, but I can't prove it, but there you go.
Yeah. Look, it's a fair point, and I think we'll probably never know. It's certainly true that people were climbing over walls, climbing over stiles. Gates were forced open. People were getting in for free. There was a lot of stuff went on in those days. And even when gate receipts were being published, there was a little bit of skepticism around that. I mean, I'm long enough in the tooth to remember FAI Cup gates, especially when the away team were entitled to a significant percentage, that dare I suggest that maybe one or two clubs in our league may not have actually given the correct attendance. Better be careful what I say.
Are you suggesting there's massaging of the figures in some league games?
But not anymore these days. But certainly, yeah, I mean, right up into the 90s at least, there were. Some of the gates were actually laughable, you know.
Yeah, I've heard stories of people that would get announced over the tannoy and then they'd kind of look around at the stadium and go, really? Is it? That seems quite high for the numbers that we're seeing. But I suppose in a general sense, though, I suppose regardless of any of that, and I say that kind of that stuff about official or unofficial figures with a bit of tongue in cheek too, but it is incredible for the league at the moment to see figures like that. And I suppose great that a record that stood for 60, 70, 80 years is now consigned to two podcasts like this, consigned to history.
It's fantastic. And I'm sure it shows the appetite there is here for live football. And look, fair play to Bohemians. It was a big risk for them to take the game.
Very big.
I mean, they could have played it in Daly Mount Park. There were significant costs involved. I think they needed 25,000 people to break even. So obviously they've done incredibly well. I saw someone describe it like a European game for Bose, or European qualification, the money they'll make out of it. And absolutely best of luck to them. It shows the appetite. And I don't think we've seen the last Dublin Derby league game, or maybe not even a Dublin Derby, but we haven't seen the last league game in the Aviva. And it's great to see. I mean, anybody who wanted to see that game on Sunday could have gone along. Had that game been in Daly Mount Park, tickets would have been pretty much impossible. I mean, I wouldn't even have tried, to be honest. I mean, the chance to get a ticket would be so slim. Hmm. So it was fantastic. We got a lot of new fans into the game on Sunday. And we can talk about those great days and the teams like Drumcondra and Cork United. Wonderful, wonderful clubs that sadly no longer exist. But we do have some great clubs still going in the league. Great clubs you can go and watch. And it was great to see on Sunday.
Absolutely, yeah. And I suppose that's enough of modern history now. That's enough of that. We don't need to talk about that anymore. We've said our bit. It's time to go back to the stuff that we know and we enjoy. The last time we left, we left around 1949-ish. The last time we talked, we were coming into the 50s in terms of the decades. It's a fascinating period, both in League of Ireland history, in history in terms of the Northern Ireland leagues as well, and I suppose international football too. So I suppose if it's possible, give us a little kind of insight into what the 50s as a decade brought in terms of Irish football, and then we'll go into bigger detail.
So I suppose if we start maybe with around late 1949, because there was a couple of significant events happened in 1949 that we did talk about. So, and maybe start north of the border when Glentoran returned to the Oval in 1949 for a huge game against Linfield, 8 years after the Oval being a bomb site. We talked briefly about Belfast Celtic the last time, hugely successful club. Went on a tour of North America in 1949. So their last game as a football club was against Cambra Turner, now IFK Gothenburg of Sweden, over in North America. So they didn't exist. Well, the club existed, but they didn't play any matches after that. So, as I mentioned, we lost Cork United before the decade came out, but they were replaced by Cork Athletic, who, of course, went on to become a very successful team. And we can't leave 1949 without talking about the national team and probably our finest hour. And certainly it's up there for debate, but maybe set the scene a little bit, because England, we talked about the home championship, and England were generally considered to be the best in the world for the 1880s, Scotland were probably the only potential rivals. And for the first half of the 20th century, they were the team. They had never been beaten on home soil. They didn't bother entering things like the World Cup in 1930, 34 and 38. They would have been just beneath them, and they would have won them too easily. So, but on the 21st of September 1949, for the first time, we had played England in Dublin. As I said, they came 2 days after hammering Northern Ireland 7-2 in Windsor Park. They came to Daly Mount and they beat us 1-0 with a late Tom Finney goal. But the return match at Everton's Goodison Park, and what a historical setting. And unfortunately, that ground is going to be lost at the end of this season. And one of the great cathedrals of English football. I know there's a lot of comments about the sight lines and all the poles in your way, but and I've only been there once, but what a pleasure it was to go there. And the whole, the atmosphere, the history, etc. And but in Goodison Park on the 21st of September 1949, in front of 52,000 people, England faced the Republic of Ireland. And when I say the Republic of Ireland, we were just a new republic at the time. We left the Commonwealth in 1948 and Ireland had been declared a republic. So, lined out in Goodison Park, some legendary names of Irish football, the likes of Jackie Carey, Con Martin, Peter Farrell, Bud Ahern, Davy Walsh, some great names. But what about the legendary names of English football? The legends of Wolverhampton, Billy Wright as captain, Bert Williams, Jesse Pye as centre-forward, Middlesbrough's inside right, Wilf Mannion, one of the greatest all-time players, the Preston plumber, Tom Finney, who broke our hearts in 46, was again playing on the wing. Jimmy Dickinson of Portsmouth. Portsmouth actually one of the great teams of the late 1940s in English football. England were overwhelming favourites. 200 fans made the journey from Dublin on the packet, as it was then, the ship, which it was an incredible journey for those fans. And I'm almost certain we lost the last of those fans only recently in John Wilkes Sr., someone I had the pleasure of meeting a couple of times, and he travelled over as a child on the boat. So he was one of those fans that was there on that momentous occasion, because England tasted defeat for the first time on home soil to a foreign nation. They'd obviously lost. We talked before about that famous win at Earsom Park when Ireland won 3-0, the St. Valentine's Day massacre. But they'd lost at home to Scotland, Wales and Ireland, but they'd never lost to foreign, I suppose, inverted commas, opposition.
Non-British.
Non-UK, whatever. And we had even left the Commonwealth at that stage as well, so there can be no dispute. So we won by 2-0. Con Martin with a penalty just after the half an hour, and Tommy Godwin of Shamrock Rovers. I might talk a little bit about a Limerick controversy on that one, but anyway, Tommy Godwin in goal had the game of his life. And he stopped everything England threw at him in the second half. And Peter Farrell, playing on his own home ground, 5 minutes from time, made the game safe. And an incredible 2-0 win for the Irish. And what a victory. And it did send shockwaves around English football.
Talk to us a little bit. You mentioned a number of names there in terms of positions around the pitch. So explain to us, talk to us a little bit about the Irish players, first of all. Where did most of these ply their trade, and was there League of Ireland players within that team too, and what did it look like?
So as I said, the goalkeeper was Tommy Godwin of Shamrock Rovers, who had actually taken the shirt from Billy Hayes of Limerick, and it didn't. Anyway, we'll go back to that one maybe. Most of our players did play cross channel, so the fullbacks were Bud Ahern, another Limerick man. He was playing at Luton Town at the time, and the legendary Johnny Carey, who would have been, of course, at Manchester United. Mm. You had the likes of Con Martin at Aston Villa. I think he was at Aston Villa then. Peter Farrell at Everton. Tommy Moroney, who would have been at West Ham. They would have been the wing-backs. Con Martin would have played centre-half that day. So you had Davy Walsh of West Brom in attack. Peter Corr, the uncle of the Corrs. the on the course, whatever.
Oh, you're name band. Dropping now.
So he played in attack that day. Willie Walsh, I think he was at Manchester City. And the other, maybe slightly controversial one, was Tommy O'Connor of Shamrock Rovers on the wing, who was picked ahead of Tommy Eglinton. Now, Tommy Eglinton, Ego, was one of the greats in Irish football. He played for both Northern Ireland and the Republic, and he was at Everton at the time, and I know he felt very, very bitter about not being picked that day. And I don't know, there are stories that, look, Tommy O'Connor had a fine game, actually, and was a fine player in his own right. But there was talk in those days, sometimes those players picked with an effort to sell them across channel. And, hey, look, Tommy O'Connor, he's this good, he's keeping Tommy Eglinton out of the Irish side. Ah. So there might have been some of that involved. But, I mean, that would be maybe a little bit unfair because Tommy O'Connor had a wonderful game that day. So there were two home-based players, both with Shamrock Rovers, and the rest of our players would have been cross-channel. But it would still have been a huge shock. Now, notwithstanding that, I mean, the likes of Johnny Carey, he was Footballer of the Year in 1948. He captained Manchester United to win the FA Cup final that year. In 1947, actually, there'd been a game that raised funds for FIFA because the home nations, FIFA was practically broke after the Second World War, and the home nations rejoined FIFA, and in 1947, they staged a game in Hampden Park where the Great Britain, or, well, the UK, whatever, they played as Great Britain against the rest of Europe. So a team picked from the four home nations, which included actually Jackie Vernon of Ireland or Northern Ireland, played against the rest of Europe. And the rest of Europe was actually captained by our own Jackie Carey, wow, who led them out in Hampden Park. And unfortunately, they went down by 6-1. But the game was deemed a huge success.
No wonder I'd never heard of it before.
We might want to keep that one a little quiet. But the game was a huge success and raised tens of thousands of pounds for FIFA, which is often seen as the way FIFA were able to keep going at the time. Hmm. So, I mean, that's the team, the legends, I suppose, of Irish football, arguably our finest hour. I know we beat them 1-0 in Stuttgart in our first ever European Championship game. So I mightn't want to take too much away from Ray Houghton, but certainly Con Martin and Peter Farrell deserve to be up there in the argument.
But I think the difference between that and maybe Stuttgart was we kind of did have a good team going to Euro 88. So it wasn't, I mean, it was a surprise to a lot of people, but it wasn't like a ripple shockwave going through football, though, wasn't it? So this was a real shockwave that went through football. And am I right in saying that England, maybe I've made this up out of my own head, but the next time they lost was to the great Hungarian side? Am I right saying that? Or have I got that completely arseways?
No, well, so their next home defeat, certainly, the next foreign team to beat them were the great Hungarian side in November 1953. By 6-3 that day as well. Now, that was certainly a game that sent shockwaves across Europe. And that was, of course, the Ferenc Puskás, Hidja Gyuri, etc. What a wonderful Hungarian side. England did, it did actually, there's a couple of stories there about, because England qualified, England finally entered the World Cup in 1950. And it was actually, it's a separate podcast, we'll talk about the names and the Irelands and everything. But for the 1950 World Cup, the home championship was used as qualification and the top two qualified for the 1950 World Cup. I'll talk about ourselves trying to qualify for that in a second. But England won the home championship and duly qualified for the 1950 World Cup in Brazil. Scotland were runners-up, but had said, we're only going to the World Cup as winners. So if we don't win the home championship, we're not going. So they turned down their place in Brazil. I don't think they'd do that today. But anyway, England went to the World Cup.
Bonkers, even just saying that. Sorry. Sorry, if we don't win, we're just not going. What's the point?
Yeah, well, that's... So England went to the World Cup, duly beat Chile in their first game. And possibly one of the greatest shocks in the history of the game happened after that, because they were actually beaten 1-0 by the USA.
Mm.
And a Haitian immigrant by the name of Larry, is it Joe Gittins, scored the only goal. And the captain was a man called Eddie McIlvenny, who later came to these shores in the 1950s and played for Waterford for many years, and actually also represented the League of Ireland. He was on a League of Ireland 11 for many times in the 50s. So
that is a full circle connection right there.
Full circle. And another thing, I mean, our own attempts to qualify for that World Cup. And this was a rather unusual one, but I have been able to verify that. A lot of the record books say we were in a three-team group with Finland and Sweden. And technically, that's not actually correct. It seems we were drawn to play Finland over two games, and the winner was to play Sweden. But in a real strange one, we actually agreed to play Sweden, and it was to count, assuming we beat Finland, which would have been expected. And the first game away to Sweden was actually played before we played Finland. So we went to Stockholm, whatever way the games were scheduled, and we were beaten 3-1. We duly did beat Finland. We drew away 1 at home. But unfortunately, Sweden came to Dublin again and beat us soundly 3-0 or 3-1. I can't recall exactly. But we were well beaten over the two games by Sweden. But they were actually a really, really strong team at the time. They had some top players playing at Milan, etc. And they made quite an impact in that World Cup.
That's right, yeah.
I think they finished third or something like that. So it was a really crack Swedish team that did beat us. One of the regrets, actually, from that World Cup was, even though we didn't qualify, subsequently, with the likes of Scotland withdrawing and other countries withdrawing, there were actually extra places on offer. And the FAI were offered a place in the World Cup, but again declined because of the costs of going to Brazil. And there were no guarantees in those days that the gate money, etc., that you get your money back. That would mean it was. Now, actually, every team that went ended up making a profit, but it was a financial risk. Obviously, those days are long, long gone, but it was a financial risk for any association to enter the World Cup in those days. And because it was so far away, it was so costly, and they were obviously traveling by boat, the players would have been away from their families for weeks and weeks on end. The FAI turned down the chance to actually go, even though we did actually try and qualify for it.
Incredible. Yeah. In terms of that team, that very famous historic team, I presume they've been commemorated and they've gotten their dues for this fabulously historic game. Do we know anything about that? Because it is a huge game in terms of Irish history.
Yeah, so there was, I mean, in 1974, there was a dinner to honour the 25th anniversary dinner to honour the team. And but by and large, I mean, the 75th anniversary of it passed by pretty much unnoticed there a few months ago. It maybe got a small mention I actually gave it a bit of a blow up myself on social media, but not too many people picked up on it. And I suppose as time goes by and people pass on, it's hard to keep the memory alive. But they were true heroes of Irish football. Mm. I mean, certainly as a Limerick man, I'm hugely proud of the likes of Bud O'Hearn, probably the greatest footballer or City has ever produced, and a legendary player for he was never capped well at Limerick, but a legendary player for Limerick, for Belfast Celtic, for Luton Town, etc., and of course for both the Republic and Northern Ireland.
Absolutely, yeah. And while we're on it, I suppose maybe, and I know there's a lot in it, and we'll probably dedicate a whole podcast to him as well, because he's a fascinating character of Irish football. But give us a little insight into Bud O'Hearn, because I suppose for somebody obviously on the west side of Ireland as well, he's a big influence, and he's an important kind of figure, isn't he, in terms of historically.
Yeah, so he, as a very young man, he started out with Limerick FC in 37-38, first season in the league. He was on the Limerick side that won the Munster Cup, made quite an impact, initially playing as a winger, as an attacker, but his talent was there for all to see, moved back into defence. He was transferred to Belfast Celtic, the great Belfast Celtic team of the 1940s, and became a legend in Belfast as well. I mean, they would have been full-time professionals. Mm. Big two in Belfast in the 40s were Belfast Celtic and Linfield, and they were battling it out for honours. So Bud was then subsequently, he moved to England. He was transferred to Luton Town and lived and passed away in Luton, actually grew up and, sorry, didn't grow up, but lived all his life. His children were raised in Luton. But he subsequently moved on to Luton Town, where he's also hugely regarded. Played, as I said, for the IFA, for the FAI, certainly of his generation, one of the best players, and probably an automatic pick for both sides at the time. Of course, he was full back on the team that beat England in 1949.
Wow. It seems just brilliant to we tend to focus on the West and outside of Dublin on this podcast, because that's kind of where our backgrounds is from. But also to, I suppose, give a nod as well to show that there was other players, there were other teams at the time that made it outside of Dublin as well. And it's interesting too, because you mentioned Belfast Celtic, that Belfast Celtic team of the 40s is probably considered one of the best teams in IFA history too, isn't it? I mean, it was just it was a brilliant team in and of itself.
Absolutely. I mean, I mentioned in the last podcast, their last games was a 10 or 11 match tour in North America. I said their last game was against Cambra Turner, but one of their games, as I mentioned in the last podcast, was a 2-0 win over the Scottish national team. So maybe it's a good thing they didn't go to the World Cup a year later if they were going to be beaten 2-0 by Belfast Celtic. But I mean, I must say as well, I mean, it was a brilliant Belfast Celtic side. There was an equally brilliant Linfield team. And another man, another ex-Limerick player, was the centre-forward, and who came up against Bud Ahern many times, was Davy Walsh. Davy was a Waterford man, but banged in goals for Limerick before signing for Linfield. But he transferred, he was with West Brom at the time of that game in 1949. But he scored a lot of goals for Linfield as well. So, I mean, Celtic and Linfield were trading trophies right through the 1940s. Mm. Incredible rivalry, attracting huge crowds. And I suppose I talked about Glentoran and the Oval. It was really only after... I think it's fair to say when Celtic went out of football that Glentoran, they have a fabulous history going back before the turn of the 20th century. But it's really only after Celtic that they really came to preeminence in Belfast. And you have what we have today, talk about the big two in Northern Ireland. It's always Linfield and Glentoran. Mm-hmm. But that Celtic team, and particularly of the 1940s, they were so successful, managed, of course, by the great Elisha Scott, who we talked about way back as the goalkeeper for the Ireland team back in the early days of the 20th century. So wonderful Celtic team, a wonderful Linfield team of the 1940s. And I will mention the Limerick connections of Bud Ahern and Davy Walsh.
But it gives us a nice segue into, I suppose, the club football at the time as well. If we look at the League of Ireland at that time as well, it looks like if you had Athletic in your name, it was a pretty good decade, the 50s, for your club, with Cork Athletic and the rise of St. Pat's as well.
Yeah, so I mentioned Cork United going out of football and Cork Athletic. So it just said Drumcondra had come to prominence, won a couple of leagues. They had been runners-up a couple of times, finally got their hands on the league trophy in 1947. They retained it in 48. I should mention Shamrock Rovers beat them in the cup final that year and got revenge for their defeat 2 years earlier. Shelburne came back and won a league in 1949, but Cork Athletic, who had only taken over from Cork United during the 48-49 season, finished near the bottom in 48-49, led by one of the legends in Cork football in Flory Burke, led by Flory Burke as captain. They won the league in 1950. They were surprisingly beaten by Transport in a second replay, I think. It was the first time the FAI Cup final ever went to three games. I know in 1970 it went to three games as well. But Transport won their only FAI Cup. I think they were captained by Pip Meegan, who was a very famous referee subsequently and referees inspector. But he was also a fine footballer. But Cork Athletic came back in 1951, and not only did they retain the league title, they won the double. They beat Shelburne in the FAI Cup final after a replay, and they ended up reaching the 52 Cup final, losing to Dundalk, and the 53 Cup final when they beat Evergreen. Again, actually, both of those were after replays. Dundalk needed a replay to beat them in 52, and they defeated Evergreen in the All Cork final of 1953, again after a replay, with both games played in Dublin, incidentally. I don't know why they dragged the two Cork teams to Dublin. And I will money. Actually mention another money, but I don't know. Because one of the stars of the 51 double team was a player by the name of Jackie Lennox from Cork Athletic. Now, not too many people around today will have seen Jackie playing football, but he did, from the money he earned from winning the double, he actually opened a fish and chip shop in Cork in 1951 into 52, and it became an institution in Cork. And as a student in UCC in the 1980s, I probably frequented Jackie Lennox's a bit too often, but there, behind the counter, doling out the chips, was Jackie Lennox himself. It was a family business. And actually helping him give out the chips was Dave Noonan, who was full back on that double-winning team.
Wow.
So you had two legends, absolute legends of Cork football in the early 1950s, both sadly no longer with us. Jackie passed away in the 90s. And sadly, we lost Lennox's last year. It closed its doors for good, and I tried to pay a nostalgic visit to it. My own daughter is in college in Cork now, and we actually tried to go on one of the last days, but unfortunately it was pouring rain and the queues were out the door, around the corner, around the back. We would have been queuing for a couple of hours in the rain, and yeah. I think I decided I'll remember it as it was in the 80s, but whatever about a legendary chip shop. And actually Jackie famously refused Bono some chips as well, because Bono had been in the shop. Well, some of that, but Bono had actually, he'd actually said, anytime you want chips, give me a call. So it's something like 5 a.m. in the morning. Jackie's at home and landline, he gets a phone call. It's Bono here, I want some chips. And he hung up the phone, he thought it was a prank, but it actually was Bono.
Well, don't call it 5 a.m. Looking for chips, in all fairness. I mean, you know.
Well, I don't know, after a few pints, as a lot of us are often looking for something to eat.
Yeah, and I suppose as well, it's one of the things that actually just connected with that too is, you mentioned in previous podcasts the success of Cork clubs, and yet here we see again Cork United is gone, it's folded, and then all of a sudden you've got Cork Athletic comes, they win league titles, they become successful. What is it with the water in Cork that they have teams that come and go, that are there, they disappear, but they win. They win league titles, they win FAI Cup. Is it just, it baffles me that they continue to just keep having this flow of successful clubs that just come in and out.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, you had Fortson's going back into the 20s, Cork FC, Cork Bohemians, Cork City. And as we said, the great Cork United, that wonderful legendary Cork Athletic side, they only lasted until 1957. They didn't see out the 1950s.
Wow.
And as I said, they'd been in four FAI Cup finals in a row. You had a new kid on the block, actually. So I had said Cork United had won the league in 1950 and 51, having Drumcondra won it 2 years before that. Shelburne had won it. So they'd kind of broken a bit of Dublin dominance. So then in Evergreen actually had a good run in the FAI Cup in 1951. They were knocked out by Shamrock Rovers. The league expanded from 10 teams to 12 for 51-52 season. So Evergreen became the second Cork club. And we had a new Dublin club as well by the name of St. Patrick's Athletic, who joined the league for 1951-52. Now, I should mention, St. Pat's had been making quite an impression in the FAI Cup. They got to the semi-finals in 1948. They were beaten by Shamrock Rovers. I think they beat Shelburne, who was one of the key clubs at the time. After that, they were there or thereabouts in the FAI Cup. They were certainly making waves. And they were admitted to the league in 1951 too. Now, Evergreen, for a club that actually, in their first season, they finished ahead of the champions, Cork Athletic, in fifth place. But really, we can't really talk about Evergreen for 51-52 because the story of 51-52 was St. Patrick's Athletic, who in their first season in the league became champions. They won the league, which was an incredible achievement. And one of the big games, they played Shelburne just after the turn of 1952. And I think they absolutely battered them. If I remember correctly, I think it was 6-0. And they finished 3 points ahead of Shelburne as champions, with Shamrock Rovers back in third place. And I probably should mention at this point as well that Shamrock Rovers, they had won the FAI Cup on occasions, but they had gone through the whole of the 1940s and now into the early 1950s without a league title. And we will come on to talk about that in more detail. But 1952 was certainly St. Pat's year. They won the league, and one of the most controversial FAI Cup ties happened that year as well, because Dundalk played St. Patrick's Athletic in the Cup and actually beat them. But there was huge controversy on whether a ball was over the line, and St. Pat's were certainly felt cheated and everything. And Dundalk beat them. Dundalk actually ended up going on to win the FAI Cup. But I know it was St. Pat's felt they were cheated in that FAI Cup tie, but they did go on to win the league. So it finished well for them.
And it's really it's a meteoric rise for St. Pat's, because as you mentioned, first league outing, they win the league, which is quite extraordinary. Do we know anything about that team? How do they do that? Because they were coming up against well-established Dublin teams as well in terms of the league, with Shamrock Rovers, Shelburne, Drumcondra, of course, were all the big rivalries too. So do we have any idea what it was that just made them go from not to 100 miles an hour winning league titles almost straight away?
I think it was. I mean, they were obviously a prominent Leinster Senior League club. They were competing strongly in the FAI Intermediate Cup and in the FAI Senior Cup. So as I said, they got to the semi-finals. They had beaten Shelburne. So they had been knocking on the door and building up quite a team. So it probably, although it was quite an achievement to come into the league and win it at the first time of asking it, and I suppose we can say Cork clubs managed that as well. it wasn't exactly a huge shock that they wouldn't come in and hit the ground running. They had quite a team in those days. So it wasn't exactly a bolt from the blue. They had been building for the last three. I mean, Pats had been formed in, I think it was 1929, in the 1920s, certainly. But it was a bit of a slow burner after that. They didn't really make much of an impact in senior football. But in the late 40s, they'd also got to Leinster Cup finals, etc. as well. So they were coming team. They were making an impression. So it wasn't an incredible achievement. But I suppose to say it wasn't a huge shock, but they did. They pushed Shelbourne into second place and Shamrock Rovers into third place. The following season, Shelbourne did get their revenge. Shelbourne were champions. Drumcondra, it was very much a Dublin league that season. Drumcondra runners-up, Shamrock Rovers in third place, and St. Pat's in fourth spot. So, but for 51-52, it was St. Pat's year, and they were the champions.
I wanted to talk to you as well about fascinating team to me as well is also Drumcondra as well, because this is a team that. You know, when you go through, read a couple of books and you go through research and you look at things like that, is it fair to say they often get kind of overlooked in terms of what they did in the league, the stuff that they did within the league because of, I suppose, their proximity to Shelbourne, Shamrock Rovers, St. Pat's, and the fact that they're not at that level anymore in terms of League of Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, I think Drumcondra were a huge loss to the League of Ireland. I mean, I am old enough to have seen them play. I mean, they went out of football in the early 70s. They were a huge club. I mean, they were the club in Talca Park. They owned Talca Park. They were the big club. I mean, Bohemians, we talk about Bohemians and a massive club, and they were founded in 1890, and they were hugely successful. But come the 1940s, Bohemians were wedded to their amateur status. And for the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Bohemians became a little bit of an irrelevance. I mean, I talked there about the four Dublin clubs being 1, 2, 3, 4, and 53. The amateurs and Bohemians were rock bottom. And for much of the 50s, 60s, Bohs didn't make an impact. They had Daly Mount Park, but they were amateurs up against professionals. And it was only really when they turned professional in 1969-70 under Tony O'Connell that they again came back to prominence to be the massive club they are today. But Drumcondra were the big club in the north side of Dublin at the time. Shamrock Rovers playing in Milltown, but still the Ringsend team. Shelbourne, obviously, from Ringsend. They were Southside teams. Pats were coming into the league in the 50s, but I suppose West Dublin, Inchicore. Drumcondra were a huge club. I mentioned Bertie Ahern being one of their celebrity fans. They were the big club on the north side of Dublin. They were drawing huge crowds. I was reading some of their programmes from that 45-46 season when they had the record attendance. And they were talking about 14,000 people at Talca Park on a weekly basis, but they had to move it to Daly Mount for the big game against Cork United. Mm-hmm. They finally won the league in 48 and won it in 49 as well, having won the cup again in 46. They were a key team going into the 1950s. They won the cup in 1954. They were battling out with the great Shamrock Rovers team in the 50s, winning alternate league titles later in the 50s. Went into Europe, played in the European Cup, played the likes of Atletico Madrid. I mean, I will say one thing on Lee's side. People still talk about the fantastic Cork team that drew with Bayern Munich. Shamrock Rovers were 4 minutes away from putting Bayern Munich out of Europe, actually, and they went on to win the trophy. Gerd Müller got a late goal, but that's another podcast. But Drumcondra actually beat Bayern Munich in 1962. They didn't knock them out. They were beaten on aggregate, but they beat them 1-0. And they remain the only Irish team to have beaten Bayern Munich. And I don't think that record is going away anytime soon. But Drumcondra also played, they played the likes of Nuremberg, Eintracht Frankfurt in Europe. The great East German side, Vorwärts, came to Dublin to play Drumcondra. They beat Odense of Denmark in Europe as well. So they were a key team in the 50s and the 60s. And I suppose a sad story to relate, maybe it's definitely one for another podcast, but Drum's last league title was in 1965. They won the league, and rock bottom of the league at that stage was a team called Waterford, who were a bit of a shambles at the time. And at the league meeting at the end of the season, Sam Prole, the legendary Prole family who owned Drumcondra, Sam Prole said to Waterford, needed to pull their socks up, that it just simply wasn't good enough. And the following season, Waterford actually went on and won the league for the very first time. And as they were winning their sixth league title in eight seasons in the 72-73 season, we were sadly seeing the end of Drumcondra, and they went out of football to be replaced by Home Farm. So it's a very sad, and I actually knew some people in Dublin in the 80s and 90s who effectively gave up on League of Ireland football after Drumcondra went down to football. There's one man, he passed away in his 80s in 2004, Eddie O'Brien, but he was telling me about his games watching Drums in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. Mm-hmm. And he never really went, when Drums went in the early 70s, he still retained an interest in football, but his team were gone. And he didn't really, mm-hmm. he couldn't have another team. And
It's interesting.
Yeah,
you say that because I know we talked about Belfast Celtic earlier in this podcast. I was reading a quote from who basically said it was in James Quinn's book No Foreign Game, and they were talking about the closure of Belfast Celtic and what it meant, and it basically said there was a dark cloud that got ripped out of the community. Nobody had anywhere to go, basically on a Saturday anymore. And it just, when these clubs die, it's not just the football stadium or the players that go along with it, it's entire communities, really, isn't it, that just feel this hollow feeling that this thing that was such a massive part of their lives just is now gone, and it's and just doesn't come back.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're a massive loss. And I mean, with all due respects to the likes of, look, there's Donegal Celtic up there, who are a great club, and in West Belfast, and there is a new club has taken on the name Belfast Celtic, but it's a very small club, frankly. The whole of West Belfast, that whole area, hasn't really ever
recovered from that.
Become recovered, and hasn't become a football stronghold. There isn't. It is a huge football stronghold, but it's Celtic of Glasgow. I think if you go and
walk around
Glasgow West Celtic. Belfast today, Glasgow Celtic, yeah, it's not. But they would have been Belfast Celtic supporters. Now, I mean, at the time, Linfield was a short walk across the Bog Meadows, and there was huge rivalry. But with all due respects, you're not going to go and watch Linfield having becoming a fan of Belfast Celtic. And there's the whole politics and God only knows what else in there as well. But even if you take it down to a Dublin context, and I mean, I can see that if you were a fan of Drumcondra and you were going along in the blue and gold, you're not suddenly going to put on a green and white scarf and go and watch Shamrock Rovers, or even go and watch the Bohemians, who were admittedly coming through. Now, maybe some people did go and watch Bohemians because they probably wouldn't have been rivals as such. But the people I even got to know and I spoke to that had been Drumcondra fans, I've obviously never met Bertie Ahern, but I do know he was a Drumcondra fan. He went to Talca as a boy to go and watch Drumcondra. He might talk now about being a Manchester United fan, but he was a Drumcondra fan. And I never hear of him going to the League of Ireland anymore. But celebrity fans are not.
Too many questions, he wouldn't know the answer to. Yeah, but it is fascinating, and I know we've talked about it a number of times in this podcast about clubs that come and go, but you know, it really does affect communities when those clubs and go and they're gone for good. And we kind of say it jokingly, but in terms of Cork and stuff like that, the teams that come and go and they move on. But I think it hits different when you're just, it's been there for so long, and it's got that huge history in that one place, and then all of a sudden it just kind of it fades and it's gone, and you're left with nothing there. And in terms of I suppose the mid to the mid 50s going into 1960, then in terms of the League of Ireland, where are we at? Because we mentioned St. Pat's and the usual kind of, I suppose, the usual suspects rear their heads then: St. Pat's, Drumcondra, and Rovers.
Yeah, St. Pat's, Drumcondra, Rovers, and of course Shelburne Maybe we're giving them a bit of a raw deal because they won the league in 47. They won it again in 53. They won some FAI Cups as well. 49 springs to mind. They were certainly one of the preeminent teams, and I think it's probably one for another podcast as we move into 53, 54, which for me was a huge season in the history of Irish football. Running on into the late 50s when Shamrock Rovers and Drumcondra, and of course Shelburne were still in the mix there as well. And of course St. Pat's, I talked about their 52 win. They went on to win the league in 55 and 56 as well. So they were a crucial part. But it was very much the Dublin clubs coming to prominence in the mid to late 50s. And of course, we have to mention Shamrock Rovers, who I talked about. They had won the league in 1938. They won it again in 39. They were the glamour club of Irish football. The 1940s were not a good time. Okay, they won a couple of FAI Cups, but they were not a good time for Shamrock Rovers. They were still a massive club. Coming into the 1950s, they had to look at the likes of Shelburne, Pats, Drumcondra's winning leagues, and definitely one for another day, but we need to talk about 53, 54, Colts. And I would say arguably, but maybe not even arguably, the most important, the most crucial league title win ever by Shamrock Rovers.
That sounds interesting. Why so?
Well, as I said, they hadn't won the league since 1939, and the other Dublin clubs had come to prominence. Paddy Code had been a legendary player for Rovers. He was a Waterford man. He had originally started out with Waterford, had been signed for Shamrock Rovers, arguably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, League of Ireland players of all time. But with a very, very young Shamrock Rovers team, as player-manager, he led them to an incredible League of Ireland title. And they beat Evergreen on the last day, basically, to take the title. Evergreen, they never won a league, but they were the runners-up. And it was considered a crucial title for Shamrock Rovers in 53-4 because a lot of that team, the famous names, I think it's one for another podcast, but the famous names on that side went on to become the Rovers side that was so prominent, so dominant in the late 50s. The team that played Manchester United in the European Cup, they won so many leagues and FAI Cups, went on into the 60s and won six FAI Cups in a row and became, I suppose, Shamrock Rovers now are the name, the biggest name in Irish football. 25 FAI Cups, what is it, 21 league titles. They are the most successful club in Irish football. But that win, that title win in 53-54 was absolutely crucial.
It's interesting that you say that. And I know we're coming near the end of the decade and coming to the end of the podcast for this week too. But it's interesting to say that because their dominance was in FAI Cups in the subsequent decades, but they didn't win a league title for, they won another one, but then they didn't win for a very long time, did they? Was it 20 years or something they didn't win a league title as well?
So they won leagues in the 50s. So they won the league in 54, they won it in 57. They went on and dominant in the late 50s, early 60s. They won the league in 63-64, which is actually a double. They also won the FAI Cup that year, beating Cork Celtic in the final. They didn't, as you said, they didn't win another league for 20 years after that. They were certainly very prominent in the FAI Cup, but it wasn't until the advent of Jim McLaughlin, I think, in 83-84, when they won a league. So they did, you could maybe argue, the Jim McLaughlin era as well. I talked about the Paddy Codes, Colts, and the 15 years without a league title and the success that followed. Mm-hmm. But again, they won the league in 64. But I think because they won six FAI Cups from 64 to 69, they were winning Cups again in the 70s, the famous, I don't think Sligo people want to hear about that one, and a very, very controversial penalty gave Shamrock Rovers a 1-0 win over Sligo Rovers. And John Carpenter, I don't think, ever holidayed in Sligo again after that one. But
the Riviera of the Sligo, West.
Oh, that's if you want to make a Sligo person angry, just mention 1978. It's And I mean, there was the whole, I mean, I think to add to the agony for Sligo Rovers, they had gone so long as well without an FAI Cup. We had talked about 1939. They did finally get their hands on the Cup in 1983 when they beat Bohemians in the rain in Dalymount. But that 78 final was a huge win for Shamrock Rovers. And that was the Johnny Giles era. But Giles certainly brought a lot of great players into Rovers. They played a lovely style of football. Mm-hmm. But it was only when Jim McLaughlin took over that they actually had the winning mentality to go on and win the league. And, of course, that was the four in a row league side that they won four leagues from 84 to 87. Mm-hmm. And three of those were doubles as well.
Brilliant. What an insight. What a great show. Really, really great stuff. We're going to call it there for this podcast. That was the 1950s with some really great teams in there, and great to see how the histories and the ups and downs of that decade as well. And also the Irish team doing fantastically well with that win against England, the first foreign team to win against England in Goodison Park as well. Fantastic stuff. In our next podcast, we're going to be talking about, I suppose, the politics, the other side of the 1950s with the IFA and the FAI.
Yeah, so there was, I mean, the relations were not good in the early 1950s, and in successive FIFA congresses before the World Cups in 1950 and 1954, the FAI and IFA were at loggerheads. They needed FIFA to intervene in some bitter disputes. So I think them, and it all involves the name Ireland and players playing for each other's associations. I think that's a podcast on their own, and that's one to talk about the next day.
Absolutely, yeah. And we are giving it a podcast on its own because there's a lot in it too. But Gary, until then, thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Don't forget you can support us on Patreon for just €5 a month, where we put that money back into the podcast to get more ears listening to us. Just go to patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. Please share the podcast on your socials and WhatsApp and spread the word about the show. Remember to support your local League of Ireland club. It's our heritage. It's our game. Until next week, bye for now.